This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida's midterm election is finally over. The recounts in the races for Senate, Governor and Agriculture Commissioner ended last Sunday, and the results are certified today. Rick Scott will be Florida's next senator. His fellow Republican Ron DeSantis heads to the governor's mansion, and Democrat Nikki Freed is the next agriculture commissioner. The last couple of weeks have been an opportunity for civics teachers to show their students how the election process works in real time.
Maybe it's just the former football player in me that just feels the need to give a big pregame speech, but I feel like young ladies and young men need to take ownership of things and don't feel that, you know, the decisions made in Washington or in Tallahassee or at the mayor's office don't affect them, because they do.
That's Matt Kiernan, 7th grade civics teacher at Renaissance Charter School at Summers in West Palm Beach. From the education desk this week, 90.7's Danielle Pryor talked to Kiernan about using the recount as a teachable moment.
So what has it been like being a civics teacher with this recount happening right in your backyard?
Oh, it's been really wild. So, you know, one of the discussions that we've had in my class, you know, I teach 7th grade, and, you know, so there's varying levels of just kind of news literacy and current event awareness. So I try to inject as much of it as possible with while still kind of remaining on track with what we're supposed to be going over, and, you know, trying not to overwhelm them with information before they're kind of there, you know, because we're sitting over here. And yet again, these kids that I teach now weren't old enough to experience the recount drama in 2000. But yet again, we're sitting here trying to determine voter intent. Yet again, we're sitting over here trying to count something and matching signatures. And so there's just all of these problems that are associated. And again, it's ironic. One of my students said, is this the best that we can do? You know, and all of my students have this very, like, very positive, futuristic, optimistic view of things, where every problem just has a solution that we just, that, like, the old people haven't thought of yet. And it's one of those things that only out of the mouths of a child could you hear something just so easy and true, which is this really the best that we can do?
Have you been down there to take a look yourself, or have you taken them at all? I'm sure they're interested to see what it looks like.
My school is located probably about 3 miles away from the supervisor of elections, so I haven't taken them down there. We've seen kind of pictures, we've seen news coverage, and then later on in my class, we end up discussing the 2000, and that's going to be particularly poignant, because by the time we get to that, we will have already, you know, felt the conclusion of whatever this particular recount feels like. And so it's funny, every year I have to teach about that, and last year I said to myself, this is dumb. Why are we still teaching this? This is before they were even born, and it seems like there's more prescient subjects that I could spend my time discussing with them. Then Florida, you know, strikes again, and now I'm going to be back talking about, as I said, voter intent and voter suppression.
So how do you plan on teaching about all of those things, you know, using the recount kind of as a stepping off point here, because they're very teachable moments?
You know, as I said, you know, kids have this kind of innate ability to kind of just look at a problem, assume there's a solution, and then go for it, right? It just seems like as we get older, we get decide that things are either, you know, unfixable or impractical to fix, right? So, you know, I imagine that at that point we'll be, once we get to that point in my curriculum, we're talking more about the expansion of voting rights, you know, from the original conception of who is a citizen and able to have the right to vote up until what it is today. And so my intention is to kind of talk about how, you know, it's nice to hear that all adult U.S. citizens are able to vote, but that, you know, sort of statement is, you know, inaccurate. And there's still many, many different ways that, you know, people's right to vote, that kind of inherent right to, you know, have their say heard and have their voice heard and counted, you know, that power and that right is taken from them in a lot of ways and through different ways. And so I guess when once we get to that point, you know, we end up discussing, you know, the stuff that we addressed in our in this election regarding disenfranchising people with, you know, felonies on their record. And I'm super excited to talk about, because for 5 years I've been saying, well, you know, this isn't fair. And the kids are like, yeah, we should fix this. And I'm like, yeah, we really should. And now for the first time, we're going to be able to say, well, we did. Right. And so I imagine that what I'll kind of go with there is focusing how there have been historical and recent efforts to either suppress the vote or expand the vote.
So how well do you think in general Floridians understand this election process, not just looking at your students,
right,
and how, you know, particularly how ballots are counted?
You know, it's hard to generalize, but so all I can do is just kind of look at my community. And so I had many staff members in my school, you know, come to me and say, what is going on regarding all of these amendments? Or how would I even entertain the notion of being an educated voter when it comes to voting for agriculture commissioner, right? And so I feel like there's just kind of this, kind of a general and a general lack of just kind of civic awareness in regards to how to vote, how best to vote. You know, every county has kind of like different standards for the way the ballots are even created. You know, I heard something the other day that it was kind of talking about how there's no election day in America. There are 10,000 election days in America because every single county and state runs things very, very differently. And so it allows for there to be a lot of just confusion baked within the system. And when you have that level of confusion and when you lack sort of just general standards of, you know, the ballot shouldn't be 20 pages long. You know why? Because people won't vote. And they'll still do the first page or two, and then they'll just skip the rest of it. And, you know, maybe that's a way to suppress people's votes, too. I think that there's just sort of a, you know, baked within the cake of our democracy or our republic is just this idea that it's just too hard, and so my voice is not worth it to even express. That they don't listen, that they don't care about people like me, that they don't want to hear my opinion. And I feel like a lot of that comes from, you know, confusing ballots, you know, commercials and campaigns and propaganda that make it seem like there is no good guys. There's only a bad choice and a worse choice. And I think that that's not an accident. I think that there's kind of been a deliberate attempt over time to make things very convoluted as a way to kind of push out and marginalize people who maybe don't, you know, have the wherewithal or the civic education to, you know, make an informed decision on the soil division representative in your area. I think generally people, you know, don't know, and then not only do they not know, because even if they want to know, where do you even go to figure stuff like that out? Where do you go to, you know, do a decent amount of research so that you can make an informed decision no matter who you want to vote for or what you want to vote for?
When it comes down to using some of the real-world examples that we're talking about, like the recount, these things can obviously be very politically charged. So yeah. How do you create a safe space for your students to learn about engaging in really political discourse, which is not something they necessarily see happening around them?
Honestly, to be very candid, there's not a lot of disagreement when we talk about things like this in the classroom, whether it's talking about, you know, banning Muslims from coming into the country or building a wall or changing people's citizenship. And, you know, I think sometimes, like, good is good and bad is bad. And, you know, 12 and 13-year-old kids, you know, that when presented with a topic, as I said, they just say, well, that should be different and here's why, you know. And I think, you know, creating an atmosphere in your classroom of being very solution-oriented. And one of the first things I talk about with them is how a good citizen is someone who doesn't just oppose something, but they propose a way to fix it. And I think that's a mentality that we need to teach people, that, like, it takes nothing to fire off a tweet or two, and it makes you feel good, but you've effected no change. How do we make things better? How do we, you know, move away from fixating on a problem to thinking about and diagnosing the solution? And I think when you come at any topic from that perspective, you won't languish in the sort of negativity that people often do. You'll just kind of identify the problem and then start chipping away at ways to make it better.
Interrelated with teaching your students how to kind of listen and share different political opinions is how to interpret the media, right? Having a healthy media literacy. So can you talk about maybe how you talk about reliability and bias?
You know, it's interesting. I have a chapter where that's the entirety of the chapter, and every year I'm trying to figure out a way to make that chapter better and more practical and more real world. And I'm struck every day by how powerless I feel when I even try to cross that Rubicon, because I feel like it is so hard to even yourself. There's so much information out there. There's so much information. Even if you could come from a mindset of, I want to take in the necessary information, digest it myself, and then produce my opinion. Even when you do that, there's such an overflow of data and facts and history that it's so much easier to just kind of rely on your gut reaction, right? And so one of the things that we discuss in the class is, like, bias is just an opinion. So to look for something that is unbiased is a fool's errand, because everything is biased, right? Because it's not just facts, it's what you do with those facts. So once we kind of establish that, like, it's kind of a false narrative to be looking for something that's non-biased, what you should be looking for is something that is properly sourced. And so, you know, I tell them that when you have people talking about things and they make a claim, you should politely ask, what's your evidence for that? I'm constantly asking my students and getting them to ask each other, you say this thing, okay, why? Why do you believe that? Where did you hear that from? So I guess, you know, to make it simple, it's about understanding what a primary source is and then recognizing that anybody discussing a primary source is going to have an opinion, and there's nothing wrong with that. Instead, I think what people should be, you know, comfortable saying is, what is your source? What is your evidence? So many of my students struggle to read it to begin with, so most of them hear things from people through word of mouth. That's not really a new human phenomenon, but it's definitely, you know, part of it. People hear things, information travels through word of mouth. And so I think, you know, telling kids that, like, if something sounds truly unbelievable, you know, maybe it is.
So the state has set a number of benchmarks for students, and how do you teach to the statewide test but still keep them engaged and teach what you want to teach as well at the same time? It's a hard balancing act.
I find it to be really easy. to be honest with you, I feel like there's nothing that I discuss in this class that is not very easily connected and correlated to the standards that I have to teach. There's 35 standards that are assessed on the end of course exam in seventh grade civics, and they range from things dealing with the Enlightenment and John Locke and the Declaration to citizenship and Federalist and Anti-Federalist and domestic and foreign policy, the three branches of government, all the way through Supreme Court cases. It's really, really a lot. Even if you just want to just quote-unquote teach to the test, you have so much to cover that, you know, there really is ought to be no reason that you can't bring anything that you think is necessary or proper to your class, because if you're a civics teacher, anything that goes on in the world is connected to something somewhere in your class if you're willing to look for it.
And one of the standards is preparing students to become active participants in our democracy. So what are some of the challenges of doing that now, but also the opportunities?
Well, I would say the biggest challenge is getting students to know why they should vote. You know, one of the topics that we just finished discussing is popular sovereignty, the notion that the power of the government ultimately comes from the people. And so, you know, I have 13-year-olds who, you know, can't even pronounce sovereignty in the first place. And so, you know, it's a lot about visualizing. And so, you know, I kind of visualize popular sovereignty being like your cell phone. Your cell phone is a shiny rectangle unless it's properly charged. And so that's the same with our democracy. To be an active participant means to put that charge into the government, to have your voice heard. It is your, you know, responsibility as a citizen, you know, eventually when you're old enough to do so, to have your voice heard by voting, but not just to vote on election day, but to care the day after election and 6 months after the election and 18 months after the election, to communicate, to pay attention and to, you know, use, you know, mass media or, you know, write an old school letter or doing something so that your representatives, the people that you've given this power to, that they know what you want to do or what you want them to do. And when they don't, you know, you need to give that power to someone else.
And that was Matt Kiernan, 7th grade civics teacher at Renaissance Charter School at Summers in West Palm Beach, talking to 90.7's Danielle Pryor. Up next, talking turkey with Chef Hari Pulapaka. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanksgiving is a time to get together with friends and family, and it's a celebration of food. Turkey may be the traditional centrepiece, but it's not for everyone. For a closer look at Thanksgiving and turkeys, we turn to Hari Pulapaka. Hari Pulapaka is the executive chef at Crest Restaurant in DeLand. Thank you so much for coming back to Intersection.
My pleasure, Matthew. Always great to be here.
So Thanksgiving, for most folks in the United States, turkey is the thing they think about for Thanksgiving. What does Thanksgiving mean to you, though?
Well, I'm a first-generation immigrant, and I came from India, and so I'm in my 33rd year in this country, and I've gone through a few iterations of Thanksgiving with my American friends and now adopted family. But to me, it's a larger way of celebrating food and thinking about food. It's certainly a food holiday, mm-hmm. and I'd like to call this week America's Food Week. And now that I'm a professional chef and having been one for so long, I'd like to think of it as a time to reinforce the idea of cooking from scratch and, you know, bringing family and friends together to the not just the common table, but also to the common kitchen. And I think food is best enjoyed when everyone's in it together as much as they can be and want to be. Mm-hmm. So in a very simplistic way, it's a time for family and friends and food that's thoughtful and meaningful, and at the very least brings all of us together at the common table. And then we can, you know, take it beyond that and think of traditional food and football and all that kind of stuff.
When you first moved to the United States, was that the first time you ate turkey?
When I first moved to the United States, I was a vegetarian. So anything meat-related was the first time I'd had it, for sure. The first time I had turkey, actually, I think, was the first time I ate in this country. Formally, my host family took me to a rather large buffet in Radford, Virginia, because I was attending Virginia Tech 2 weeks into my stay here. And I remember this gigantic, you know, four times as big as Golden Corral kind of a place. Mm-hmm. And I was completely intimidated by how much food there was. And I had no clue about how to attack the food or what to put on a plate. And so I just took a wild guess. And I recall taking a piece of turkey. I thought it was chicken, but it wasn't. It was turkey. And it tasted rather different from the chicken I had imagined, even though I had never eaten meat before. So yeah, that was the first time I ate turkey. And then since then, you know, I've cooked turkey many a time. In a moment of trying to be healthier, I might gravitate more towards turkey versus chicken. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't think I've really eaten turkey that much in my life, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, chicken probably a lot more than turkey.
Is your restaurant open on Thanksgiving?
This year, my restaurant is not open on Thanksgiving. About a year ago, we moved to an events-only format. And in the past, I've done every version of traditional Thanksgiving meal, including the full Monty, if you will. Mm-hmm. But just lately, you know, the current format that we're in, we chose to allow our staff to be with their families and ourselves to be with our families. And so instead, I'm doing little to no cooking, I believe, on that date. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to what others have to cook for me.
If you were to cook the full Monty, so to speak, the traditional Thanksgiving turkey, how would you do it?
So I treat it like a really large bird, which is what it tends to be, typically, right? So there's a classic way of cooking a whole turkey with stuffing under the skin and all those aromatic flavored butters and things like that, and putting it over a mirepoix of vegetables and herbs and what have you, and then just doing the proper two-step process of trying to get some crisp followed by some full cooking. But I would think that the next time I cook a whole turkey, I would probably dissect the parts and cook mm-hmm. the different parts differently, because I think you're able to control more how it happens and what flavors you can impart to the different aspects. Because I feel like even though people go to great lengths to really make elaborate stuffings and brinings and marinating and all of that stuff with their big bird, I really don't think that translates to this wow necessarily at the table. Mm-hmm. So I feel like as a chef, if I'm able to take the white meat away from the dark meat and take some of the even offal meat away from the dark meat and to cook all of those things differently in the way that I would normally cook those organs or those parts, I'm able to present that same turkey, of course, dissected, but also celebrated in ways that gastronomically make sense.
The image, though, or the appearance is kind of important, though. Right? People, in some ways, might expect to see the gleaming bird, you know, the roasted whole bird. How do you get around that?
You're absolutely correct, and they did probably do, but that's where food styling comes into play a little bit, and you can, frankly, garnish a centerpiece that consists mostly of different parts of the bird in a number of ways to, I would argue, a more dramatic presentation. So height, color, textures. In fact, having a platter of food where there's so much diversity of preparation, I think has the chance of being even more dramatic.
Mm-hmm. For chefs and restaurant owners, is there a bit of a kind of tension around holidays like Thanksgiving? Because a lot of people like to go out and eat on Thanksgiving rather holidays, but for yourself, I mean, you might want to take a break. You might want to give your staff a day off, time to celebrate with family. How do you balance the two?
That is absolutely a valid point, and frankly, it's something I refer to quite a bit when I try to describe what the profession's like to people who may not know what that profession's like or what it entails. Essentially, in the restaurant business, we get to work when everyone else wants to play or get to play, and holidays are no different. So especially, but the difference between holidays and typical weekends, where that's still the case, with weekends, okay, you can still kind of catch up and move on with your normal life. But with holidays, it sort of appears only, you know, those days only appear so many times a year, sometimes just once a year, for example, mm-hmm. for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So to miss that out entirely with in the way you would normally function that day and enjoy that day if you were not in the profession does take its toll over a long period of time. And I know a lot of young cooks, at least, get very disgruntled and very frustrated at the fact that, you know, essentially that they have to be cooped up in the kitchen, no pun intended.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking with Hari Pulapaka. He's the executive chef at Cress Restaurant in DeLand, talking about Thanksgiving. One other thing that I've read about is that turkeys are getting a bit smaller. Is that something you've noticed as a chef?
I have, when I paid attention. I do think turkeys are getting smaller, which I think speak a little bit to perhaps the slight shift in the way mass big food is being produced. So they're getting smaller. I suspect would mean that we're pumping less stuff into them. Mm-hmm. We're letting them grow a little bit more naturally, perhaps.
And is that because people want that they're more concerned with flavor than appearance?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I'm always distraught at the lack of flavor in grocery store products. It's always amazing to me. And a turkey would be no different. I mean, it's quite impressive how large these things get. Mm-hmm. And how big they are and what a dramatic presentation they provide for the dinner table or the lunch table. And then that's what I spoke to earlier, and tried to dissect the different parts and cook them differently and control that flavor actually does justice to the animal, the bird in this case, if you will. Mm-hmm. But just roasting a whole bird, it's already bland to begin with, and to try to really get it to any kind of flavor intensity takes a lot of effort and technique and skill. But to answer your question about the birds getting smaller each year, seemingly, I think that's true. And if it's for the reasons that I'm thinking as to why they're getting smaller, I'm celebrating already, because that to me tells me that we're perhaps in some small way as an industry getting back to flavor before volume and mm-hmm. making the most bang for the buck.
Talking about flavor and appearance, one of the things you do is you focus on so-called trash fish, right? Like fish which may not look cool. They may not be popular fish to put on the dinner table, but they taste pretty good. Is there something similar going on in the poultry business?
Well, I don't know if that's along the same lines, but I do think, and to the equivalent to me, the analog would be to look at other kinds of birds or other kinds of species. But the fact that the birds today are seemingly smaller and perhaps more flavor-packed, I think speaks as much to the fact that there's more demand. And you look at every big corporation that has anything to do with food, and they're promoting their sustainability statements, and they're talking about the better practices that they have in place, and they're thinking about the planet, and they're thinking about the future, not just the bottom line as we've always thought they did. So I'm hoping that's the case, and that makes me feel good. But I do think, having said that, there's a lot of food waste in this country. Mm-hmm. And so at the very least, when these birds are so large and it's a family of two trying to consume a 15-pound bird, you know, there's bound to be some boredom after day four. Mm-hmm. And you're probably going to not consume everything you had. And there's probably some waste there. So that's always a travesty and a tragedy. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that these smaller sized ingredients allow us to perhaps consume them better and consume them more wholesomely and fully, and possibly then resulting in a smaller food waste quotient, if you will. So that's a good thing as well.
For folks who are vegetarian or even vegan, what does Thanksgiving represent to them? Is it a challenge? Is it an opportunity?
Absolutely, both. It's definitely a challenge because despite all of the activism and the awareness about vegetarianism and plant-based food in this country, it's still woefully lacking in many ways, and chefs are just as guilty of that as members of the household because there's not necessarily an education, there's not a training, there's not a commitment, there's not necessarily an awareness of what all could be done with plant-based ingredients. So it definitely presents both an opportunity as well as a challenge, the challenge being essentially that you don't quite have that dramatic array of food that everybody else has. The opportunity then is just that, is quite the complement of that. It allows chefs who care, I do, for example, to reach a little bit deeper into your repertoire and your arsenal to try to figure out ways to make that food more meaningful. And I recently joked, I saw this video going through Facebook. I can't help but mention it, about somebody presenting a big giant cabbage, glazed and roasted and glazed many times and marinated and glazed one more time and presented as a centerpiece, mm-hmm. as for the vegetarian at the house. And the tagline was something like this: if this won't bring the vegans to the Thanksgiving table, you know, I don't know what will. And it was this really dramatic, really caramelized, golden brown, highly glazed cabbage. So my comment there was simply, well, that's a lot of drama for a big roasted vegetable, mm-hmm. because I don't think that necessarily is what this is about. I mean, that's not what a vegetarian is looking for.
Right.
That's not the equivalent of spending 10 hours brining a turkey and stuffing it with everything imaginable and then carving it quite dramatically at the table and on making these leftover things for days on end.
Mm-hmm.
That roasted cabbage doesn't do justice to what those other people do with that.
Up a full Thanksgiving meal with just the trimmings and the sides, though?
Oh, my. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, I don't see why you can't serve a big, dramatic vegetarian Wellington or quote-unquote meatloaf as a centerpiece. And one carves into it, and it's really rich and decadent, and it oozes, you know, flavor. And then the side dishes are actually, I mean, I always think of bacon as being a crutch. I might get admonished and scolded by my colleagues for saying that, but I don't think bacon's always necessary in everything. It's definitely a crutch that a lot of chefs use to create flavor when they don't know how to create flavor otherwise. So a lot of the sides that are traditional at the Thanksgiving table tend to also still have those drippings and all of that kind of stuff, and they're completely unnecessary in my opinion. You can create, I mean, think of it this way. The country of India has, you know, about 350 million vegetarians, possibly.
That's quite a few.
Right? That's quite a few. And so we have food-related festivals year-round. And we have quite dramatic spreads all year-round. And it's such a diversity of food. We don't miss a big, giant bird in the middle of the table to make our meal feel festive or celebratory. So I think there's a lot to learn from cultures like that, how to make a dinner table dramatic for everyone, including vegetarians, because you don't have to always lean on a giant protein to make the statement. I know it comes from a certain place in history, why that happens and how food is presented that way, but I think there are a lot of cultures around the world, in India specifically, so I'm fortunate that I can say that I have that experience, where you can really create quite a dramatic array of dishes that will be considered a feast by any measure.
Ari Pulapaka is the executive chef at Chris Restaurant in DeLand. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well. What are you going to have for Thanksgiving?
That is a good question. I'm not actually in charge of cooking, so I guess I'll find out.
Fair enough. Actually, now I'm eating out at a restaurant, so I have no idea either.
Yeah, to be determined, but I'm sure it'll be good, by the way. Still to come, ramping up rocket launches on the Space Coast. A conversation with the commander of the U.S. Air Force 45th Space Wing. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Every rocket launch from Cape Canaveral falls under the watchful eye of the Air Force's 45th Space Wing. Headquartered at Patrick Air Force Base, the wing is responsible for the safety of the launch, including the weather, and the safety of the residents of Florida's Space Coast. Air Force leaders want to ramp up launches from the Cape, targeting 48 launches a year. That drive falls under the command of the new leader of the 45th Space Wing, Brigadier General Douglas A. Schess. 90.7's Brendan Byrne sat down with Schess to talk about the 45th's role in launching rockets and the upgrades happening at the base to help support more launches.
First of all, let's start with kind of explaining the role of the 45th in launching rockets.
Sure.
What's your job here?
Yeah, so we kind of have two aspects to our job from the launching the rocket standpoint. The first is what we call range safety. So we have the Eastern Range here that's a huge instrumentation part of the, basically a big portion of the Atlantic Ocean, that we're responsible to make sure that a rocket is safe from a public safety standpoint. In other words, we don't want a rocket to endanger the public. Second, we need to do resource protection. From a still range safety perspective, we need to do resource protection. And so a lot of the things that we have at the Cape Canaveral and Kennedy Space Center are important to other space launches, and so we need to make sure that we protect those during a launch. The other part of that is what we call mission assurance. So in other words, we need to make sure, especially when it's a national security space satellite, we need to make sure that the contractors that are preparing the rocket and actually getting the rocket ready to launch have done everything that they need to do to make sure that that rocket's going to get that satellite to the proper orbit. So that mission assurance is us doing that second set of eyes on what the contractor's doing to be able to make sure that it's going to get in the right orbit.
When do those preparations start ahead of a launch?
Yeah. So part of it depends on which rocket and which satellite. So a lot of the satellites get built somewhere else, and then they come here and they get their final processing in this area. Depending upon what kind of satellite, some of that's done on Cape Canaveral, some of that's done at Kennedy Space Center, and some of it's done in private companies that are around the area. And then the rocket as well is a lot of times built in other places, and so that it all comes together here. For example, SpaceX, they're continually doing launches on a pretty regular basis, and so could be, you know, a month out we're doing different things. Now, different or unique launches, maybe when we did the Falcon 9 Heavy or the Delta IV Heavy, could be many months that we're doing it. The satellite part, actually, when we're making sure that the satellite's getting mated to what we call the upper stage of the rocket and then putting the payload fairings on it, that could be very lots of weeks too, up to months preparing that. And so the folks that are doing mission assurance have to make sure that all that's ready. So it's not a great answer, but it depends on the satellite and the rocket. So
now you mentioned one of the things that you look for is public safety. Mm-hmm. Are you also looking at things like space traffic? Do you have to keep in mind what's above us at the time?
Yeah, actually that's kind of interesting. So one of my previous jobs, I was the commander of the 21st Space Wing at Peterson Air Force Base. And they have a squadron that does what we call the space catalog. But it also is just monitoring all of basically everything that's in space, and they're keeping track of that for us. So when we do a launch, we have what we call a collision avoidance. And so, in other words, we go out to that squadron and we say, hey, we're going to launch a rocket on this azimuth for this orbit at this time. Can you do a run for us to make sure that we're not going to, you know, hit anything on the way there? And so they do that. They do it many weeks in advance. So we kind of get, but then of course, actually, while we're sitting down on the countdown, we do another one and we take a look at what's out there and make sure that we don't put any danger to the new satellite that's on its way up or the rocket to make sure that we don't actually do the monitoring to know where everything is. That's what the 21st Space Wing does out at Peterson. But we work with them to be able to make sure that we are as safe as possible.
You don't hit it on the way up, right?
No. So actually, it's kind of funny. You could actually hit something because we take a risk of this is a pretty small piece and it's going to be okay. I say that, but then for the International Space Station, a little piece would be very dangerous. And so, but for a rocket, might depends on where it's at in the orbit and where it's going. Maybe the payload fairing's still on and it's not a big deal. But we have very smart people in our safety and in our collision avoidance that say, yeah, this is good to go. And it depends on actually who we're launching it for. So if it's a commercial company, they decide whether we're going to – we have what we call range safety. Now, there's no way we're going to go through that. But then they decide if maybe it doesn't meet the range safety, but maybe it meets their, hey, we don't want to take a chance.
What about weather forecasting? That's another important aspect of launches that you take care of, General. Can you kind of explain the role they play?
Yeah, so we have the 45th Weather Squadron here that's a part of our wing, and they do an incredible job of making sure that we're ready to launch on launch day. So this is probably the best place in the world to launch the kind of orbits that we launch into. Our sister wing, Vandenberg, 30th Space Wing out at Vandenberg, they launch different types of orbits, and they're perfect for where they're at. But geographically, this is a great spot. However, this is the lightning capital of the world, per se, or at least the United States, and so that makes things a little bit more difficult. Lightning and rockets don't necessarily go together very well, and so but there's all kinds of other things, different kinds of clouds, different kinds of just the electromagnetism that's in the air, rain, all those things. And so we have very specialized weather officers. We call them launch weather officers. They get trained in what all the criteria. And from several decades ago, people put together what's a criteria that this is okay to launch through. And so these weather officers spend quite a bit of time getting certified. Different thing than the, you know, your weather that's just doing like an airfield or something like that. Although these folks know how to do that as well. So they get trained, and then they sit on console with us during the launch, and they're continually evaluated. We have all kinds of instrumentation to give us the best forecasting capability that we can have. And I've sat on launches before where you're driving up to the Cape and you're like, there is no way, the weather is completely bad. And then I walk in and the weather forecaster's like, hey, sir, we got, you know, depending upon the launch window, which depends on what the satellite is and the orbit it's going to, hey, sir, it looks like we got a 10-minute window that we're going to be able to launch through. And sure enough, most times they're right, and then we launch through that. But they're also, you know, sometimes they're telling us, hey, we're not going to be able to launch, you know, during this window. And but a lot of times we still sit in the count because you just never know. Weather's not – they do a great job forecasting, but weather changes, you know, pretty darn quick.
And some of the instruments that you use for those weather forecasts are the same satellites that you're launching here, right?
Right. So we obviously have weather satellites, both Department of Defense and commercial, the NOAA satellites. But we also have a lot of instrumentation just around the Cape and the local area, too. We do weather balloons, send up a weather balloon that's given us the wind data and things like that. But we have all kinds of weather visualization is the next thing we're doing, is we're moving into what we call our multi-domain operations center. So we're taking the instrumentation we have and maybe taking it to a next level. It's this innovation. So for instance, we might observe lightning in the area, and in the past we've had to go, okay, we don't quite know exactly where that lightning is or was, and is it going to be in the path of the rocket? And so maybe we make some more what I'll call conservative decisions on not launching during this time. But we're taking all of that data. They're using higher fidelity algorithms and putting that together. So then they can actually look through, hey, here's where the rocket is going. And they can say, you know what, even though that lightning just happened, it's not going to be anywhere near where we're going. So those, a lot of innovative folks in the weather business trying to get it so that we can launch more often as we drive to 48 to get to 48 launches. We don't want weather to be the thing that holds us back, even though we know that we have to, you know, be mindful of it.
You just mentioned it, that drive to 48. That's 48 launches in a year, right?
Correct.
That's the goal.
Yeah, and it's kind of a, you know, we just threw it out there. I'm not saying that it didn't have a lot of data behind it, because it does. But we just, hey, this is a big goal that we're going after. And what that really means is there's obviously 52 weeks in a year. We need about 2 weeks twice a year to what we call recapitalize and do maintenance on the range. And so we take all that instrumentation, maybe do some periodic maintenance on it, or we bring in a new capability. So if you take those 4 weeks out, that leaves 48, and we say, hey, let's launch a rocket once a week. But I don't know that we're going to stop there. Maybe we're going to launch a rocket once a day. But right now what we're seeing, we're at 21 launches this year, and our schedule, it always is changing based on what's going on, and we have at least four more scheduled for the year, maybe five. So we're really hoping to get to 24, 25, maybe 26, so we can say we're halfway to 48, but most of our schedule looking out to 2019 is around 30. And so we're on the way. But it's not just the innovation that we have to do and the things that we have to do for the instrumentation. It's a culture. It's a culture of, we want to be as fast as we can so that we can be good customers with our commercial folks that are launching to for their business, but then the next day they're launching for us for our national security space, and that's what the great teamwork we have here together.
Would the 24 launches, would that be a record for...
So we really think way back in the heyday, they probably launched a lot more than that, and maybe not all of them were orbital, maybe suborbital. But in the latest period of time where we really kept great track of it, we had 23 launches in 2016. That's a pretty good year. But we believe if we can get to 24, 25, that will be the most we've had in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, launches are ramping up with some private customers that
correct.
You spoke about, all these different national security missions. What are you doing here on the base to prepare for such a packed schedule of launches?
Yeah, so one of the things we're doing under General Raymond's leadership, the commander of Air Force Space Command, is looking to make sure that we're not duplicative in our efforts. So in other words, you mentioned commercial companies. So while we still have a requirement because they're launching from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station or Kennedy Space Center, we have that requirement for protection of resources and protection of the public. The Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, actually licensed some of those folks to launch when it's a commercial launch. And if they can tell the FAA that they have everything they need to do to be able to take care of that public safety, then we still have our part of resource protection and others, but we kind of allow them. We want to make sure that when they go through the FAA process and our process, that we're not duplicative. In other words, for that company, they don't have to think, oh, I'm going to do something different when I talk to the 45th Space Wing than I am when I go to FAA, or even I'm going to talk when I go to Vandenberg different. And so get rid of some of those duplicative efforts. We want to be able to change the range faster. So in other words, that's bringing up the instrumentation. One of the things we did is we used to have big, huge antennas that take a lot of maintenance and a lot of care, and we still have them, but we also have these things called frequency control vans. And so, you know, satellites sometimes can be very susceptible to different frequencies out there that might hurt them while they're here, you know, on the Earth before they get launched. And so a lot of times we'd use those vans to measure the frequency. So in other words, maybe a ship, maybe a cruise ship, maybe some other ships out off, and they're using a frequency that would maybe hurt our satellites. So our vans would be out monitoring that spectrum, and they'd be able to say, hey, hold on, we're seeing some spectrum over here. Well, those same things can do telemetry antennas. And so we had very innovative civilians and military folks that said, let's turn some of those vans into some telemetry vans. And so then that gets us away from that big static antenna. Obviously, things that help that are, you know, networks that are faster, and so you can have a smaller antenna. And so we're looking at different ways to do that, because if, you know, for instance, instead of having a bunch of static antennas across the range, if I had a bunch of vans and then I can move it over here when I'm launching here today, and then I move it over here when I'm launching some other day, and then I can bring it into a hangar, do all the maintenance instead of going out to a big antenna and doing it. So that's one of the things that we're working on, is to be able to make the range faster, be able to turn the range around. You know, in other words, launch today for, you know, SpaceX with this satellite, launch tomorrow with ULA and a different satellite, and being able to turn the range around to have a different configuration than it had the day before. And so a lot of innovative things going on to make sure that we can go faster.
Are other launch facilities looking to you to kind of see the best practices that you've tried in and kind of utilizing them at other launch facilities?
Yeah, so we're really working together with our sister wing out at Vandenberg Air Force Base that does launches out there. And so, as a matter of fact, we're meeting all the time. We call it Range of the Future. Mm-hmm. You know, how can we make the range more modernized? And so we're working together. But we also are a part of what we call the Range Commanders Council. And so up in Wallops in Virginia, NASA has a range up there. They do mostly suborbital up there, but they can do orbital. We work together with them, and we make sure that we have you know, best practices, lessons learned, and work those through those council to make sure. And then we've always had a great relationship, but we have probably the best relationship ever seen with our commercial customers. You know, and that sometimes they have great ideas, and we're the open communication we have with SpaceX, ULA, and then bringing on the new customers with Blue Origin and others. We're working together with them to make sure that by working together, we're going to be better at this.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think you'll get to a point where you have to turn customers away or turn launches away?
I hope not. One of the things, I guess, if you think about it, is the Cape Canaveral is only so big. It is big, but it's only so big. If we continue to bring other customers on and maybe they'll start to be too close to each other. But I don't see it right now. You know, if I was doing my mission brief, I have a big picture of the Cape, and I show what we're doing now, and then I show what we're going to do in the next 5 years, and we're adding lots more capabilities. So I don't see that happening in the near future. But hopefully we're going to be so innovative and thinking through that that won't ever happen. So
now there's some other private launch facilities opening up across the country in Camden. There's one in down in Texas. Mm-hmm. Is that a threat to Cape Canaveral and what you do here?
Yeah, so we never think of it as a threat. Obviously, we have the resources here that we need to be able to launch the national security space satellites with. And the more folks that are launching, the more folks that are bringing innovation to it, it's great. You know, one of the things that we do here that you really can't do in other places right now, per se, is that we can make sure that you don't launch over people. And so they've got a lot of things that they've got to work out at those other places to be able to say, hey, here's a rocket that's going to launch from, you know, somewhere that's going to go over a public area. But I don't see it as a threat. I see it as continuing to work together and continuing to find ways to be more effective at what we do. Mm-hmm. So,
do you feel that you have to sell the 45th Space Wing to launch companies, or is it a clear bet to come down here and launch your rockets?
Well, so I don't think we have to sell. I think obviously because of the resources we have and the space launch complexes we have, that people want to come here. And as long as we continue to innovate and work together with them, I think they're going to want to be here. One of the big benefits is we say when you're going to launch a national security space satellite, you're going to launch it from here or Vandenberg. And so they know that those same rockets that launch those also want to launch their commercial. And so having them work together here, I think helps them out with their business case of, I'm going to launch a GPS satellite today, and then tomorrow I'm going to launch a satellite for our commercial communications company. So I don't think I have to sell it. But, the one thing is, that we do have to do is just talk about the partnerships we have with NASA and others. Because sometimes I think, I'll be downtown and talking to someone and they won't even know that the folks here at Patrick are a part of what's going on. And so maybe that's our fault a little bit for not, tooting our own horn per se. But we have a pretty good relationship with those, with NASA and others, and making sure that this is the place to launch rockets from. So
now, something that was unique to Cape Canaveral until a few weeks ago was not only were you launching rockets, but rockets were landing here,
yes,
too, with SpaceX.
Yes, right.
What goes into prepping for a booster landing like that? Is it a launch in reverse? Like, what's your role in that?
Well, in a sense, it is a launch in reverse, which is that's interesting you say. So when I was here 2012 to 2014, I was the ops group commander, and we did not bring rockets back. And I'd probably say most of the folks that they were talking about it a little bit. So even there, that just by the fact I'm saying I left in 2014, we weren't quite ready yet. And so now, just 4 years later, they've done a bunch of landings. I think we're up to 24 landings since 2015. And so that's pretty amazing that in 4 years, we're now landing on a regular basis. And it is a launch in reverse because we still have to do that public safety because you got a rocket. The interesting part is I haven't been here for one yet that's come back. We had one come back, onto a barge, mm-hmm. but we haven't had one come back to the land. That'll happen here in the next few months or whatever. But from what I understand, it looks pretty interesting of this rocket coming back. And so I look forward to seeing one. But you're right, we have to do the same thing, telemetry, radar, all those things to make sure that the rocket is staying on track as it comes back, because we obviously don't want it to go off course and do something that it shouldn't do.
What are some of the things you're doing to preserve the history of Cape Canaveral and the 45th Space Wing? I mean, this place has such a storied history when it comes to space exploration.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we partner with, we have a museum up at the Cape Canaveral, and there's a museum foundation that's a private organization that works through that. And so we are trying to make sure that we keep good care of the nation's space history, obviously working with Kennedy Space Center, who has some of that history as well. But our museum is a thing. The one part that's always hard for us is, we have to protect the base. And so there's a lot of stuff behind the wire that we'd like to be able to open up to the public. And so trying to find, working with our foundation, what can we take outside the fence and be able to show the public? And so but this is also a pretty harsh environment. You think about it, it's a beautiful beach, you're out on the beach, but there's the salt water and just the weather out here that we have to be able to restore. So we have to, pay for that, actually, to, keep some of those things in what I'd call pristine enough state to show. So we're working through that, and we want to be a good stewardship of our nation's history. So
that was 90.7's Brendan Byrne speaking with the commander of the 45th Space Wing, Brigadier General Douglas A. Schess. You can hear that and other conversations about space exploration by subscribing to WMFE's podcast, Are We There Yet? You can find it on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or Spotify, and we're on the NPR One app. We're in the final weeks of our fall silent drive. To support the interviews you hear on Intersection and the in-depth reporting from 90.7 News, make a contribution. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go to our website, wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.